John Barnard revolutionised Formula One and motorsport as a whole through his unrelenting quest for perfection in racing car design. The new book, The Perfect Car, the biography of John Barnard, was written with Barnard's cooperation and with input from dozens of associates, drivers and rivals, telling the entire story, both personal and professional, of a British design genius. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, Nick Skeens himself. Nick, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you.
Good to have you with us. It's something that the British seem to do well, isn't it? Design geniuses, especially when it comes to F1.
Yes, well, I mean, there's a long history of design genius, of course, in Britain and in Formula One and motorsport in general. And this has become the centre, the world centre for design excellence in motorsport. And John Barnard was one of the reasons why that happened.
So tell me a little bit about, for those who don't know, because you might know the names of the drivers, you might know your Prost, you might know your Mansells or your Sennas, or even your John Watsons, but explain a little bit about what Barnard brought to the motorsports party, if you like.
Well, he was known in his time because his golden era was the 80s, especially, and into the 90s. And he was known particularly because he arrived trailing clouds of glory from America, where he had revolutionized IndyCar through a car called the Yellow Submarine, or the 2K, which is still much revered in America. And he came here, and Ron Dennis of McLaren saw the work he'd done in America and thought, this is the guy for me. Ron Dennis wanted to get into Formula One, and between the two of them, they took over McLaren and completely revolutionized motorsport. It was John's genius for very complicated and very clever technical innovation, especially introducing aerospace technology, such as carbon fibre in particular, and a whole host of other breakthroughs.
So where did he get the... Because McLaren, when Ron Dennis came to it, was very much a team, if you like, the old guard who had been with McLaren when Bruce had founded the team running, and people like Teddy Mayer, and they'd had the championships with James Hunt in 76, and before then was with Emerson Fittipaldi. But that was a team, if you like, that was having a complete change in its personnel and its management.
It was. Well, it was in trouble. Marlboro were about to pull the plug, as it was put by Tyler Alexander, one of the sort of, people that helped McLaren recover after the death of Bruce McLaren. Basically, their problem was there'd been a revolution in Formula One, and this was called ground effect, and this was created in the main by... Colin Chapman of Lotus and his aerodynamicist Peter Wright, and John Barnard had taken on this revolution and taken it to America and created this Chaparral 2K, the Yellow Submarine. And so McLaren was in serious trouble, Team McLaren as it sort of was known then, and they were just going down the grid. Their last major win, of course, was a James Hunt victory in the championship in 76, I believe. And so when John arrived, he came in with this fantastic, understanding of ground effect, this curious design of the underneath of the car to create what's called a Venturi effect, which effectively sucked the car to the ground so it whizzed around the corners at very high speed. And his understanding of that started helping McLaren. But the first thing he did, and the deal that he had with Ron Dennis, was, look, I want to create something entirely new, which was what Barnard was all about. And he created the incredibly complicated but immensely strong carbon fiber car. The whole chassis was made of carbon fiber. And this against all the odds, because everybody at the time thought carbon fiber would never work in motorsport, and indeed in sport in general it caused disaster. 15 people died in the Fastnet race because people didn't understand carbon fiber, and the carbon fiber rudders and keels snapped. So he brought in an entirely new understanding.
And I mean, we think strange to think of that now, because carbon fiber is an integral part of any racing, I suppose. But the strength that carbon fiber had when used properly made the whole sport, I might say, for none more so than when John Watson, who was a McLaren driver, had a monstrous crash at Monza.
Yes, in 1981. This was a big proving ground, if you will, for carbon fiber. There was a lot of doubt Gordon Murray of Brabham, a designer at Brabham, had made some progress with carbon fibre, but the problem was is because it was misunderstood, that is to say they didn't know how to make it properly, it would snap, and people died as a result of accidents in Formula One because of a failure to understand it. But what John Barnard did was work with British Aerospace, a boffin from there called Arthur Webb, and then in close concert with Hercules Aerospace out in Utah, who he went to a number of British companies at the time to try and persuade them to make to help him build this carbon fiber car because it takes a certain high level of technology. But no one in Britain was prepared to take it on, so the Americans took it on. And the result was at that crash when was that the car survived. Everybody watching it, I mean, and you may recall, or people who look it up on YouTube will remember the fantastic commentary by Murray Walker, in which he says, and Watson's coming round the Lesmo curve, and he loses it, and it looks like a very bad one indeed. And it did. The car broke in half at the back. The whole gear box and engine was ripped off, and a massive explosion of flame, which happily went out immediately for a variety of reasons. But everybody thought that there was no way he was going to survive that. And John Watson, as he describes it, said he just thought it was an average shunt. And he saw the engine. Then he turned around and he saw an engine coming past him. And he thought, oh, no, I've caused a multiple pileup. And then he realized it was his engine.
I mean, I remember watching it on TV and hearing that commentary, and yeah, the car split in two, but the cockpit, the structural strength of the cockpit meant that he, you know, whereas before anything could have happened, he was saved by, and it's, I mean, Lesmo corners, a tremendous speed at the entry as well.
Something like 160 miles an hour or something ridiculous, he's coming out of there. He got his wheels on the grass, spun, hit the barrier, didn't think the accident was that big because the carbon managed to, well, it has this fantastic quality of when it starts breaking, it breaks in such a way that all the shock is dissipated. And he got out and realized the damage is done, and his major concern was how angry John Barnard was going to be because he'd just wrecked his car. From a silly mistake, which it was really.
But I mean, literally, within a couple of years from that, from 1981, he was McLaren were leading championship. Niki Lauda won a championship in 1984. Alain Prost went on to win championships as well.
That's right, and they dominated right through the 80s with the technology that John Barnard had set up, especially the 1988 car, which was designed by a guy called Steve Nichols, who was a pupil of John Barnard, and that went on to be the most successful car in Formula One. It won every race but the race at Monza when John Barnard, who by then was at Ferrari, managed to win that race.
So, and I mean,
he did a bit of a monster for himself there.
What was the reaction of the other teams like then when they saw this car? Did everybody say, blimey, this carbon, you know, when handled right, this carbon fiber is something to we've got to get hold of?
Well, I think there was a collective groan because the costs, of course, are enormous. And they realised they were going to have to go that way because carbon fibre is so much lighter and stiffer than the aluminium and steel structures that they were using. So, yes, they did have to follow him. And he was a new boy. This was an amazing debut, he and Ron Dennis coming into Formula One and winning the British Championship in their first year of operation with this new car, and then going on to dominate, as you say, with Niki Lauda, Alan Prost, Ayrton Senna, of course, later after John Barnard had left. So it was one of a series of revolutions that just changed right across motorsport, which came from the pencil of John Barnard.
Now, tell me a little bit about his reputation, or his, if you like, nickname, though I doubt anybody ever called it to his face, the Prince of Darkness.
Yes, well, this came from, it was Tyler Alexander, one of the partners of McLaren, that coined it. I say coined it, he actually nicked it from the film The Verdict, in which one person describes a lawyer as the Prince of, and then a swear word, darkness. And he gave this name to John Barnard because when John Barnard came into McLaren, he was clashing with all the mechanics. Now, in those days, the mechanics were kind of artisan mechanics. They were designers to a point, insofar as when the designers in the drawing office sent drawings down to the workshop to be created, to be turned into various car parts, they were never perfect. And they always had to be rely on the creativity and experience of the mechanics. But John Barnard was of a different breed. When he drew something, it was right, and he wanted it built exactly like that. And also, of course, he was drawing up designs for carbon fiber, which, as he described, it was more like tailoring. It wasn't like sort of specifying a certain amount of aluminium. It was layers of carbon cloth in different directions, depending on where you wanted the force loads to act. And they just could not accept, quite a number of them could not accept that this revolution was going to work. And basically, he got the name Prince of Darkness because he had so many arguments with them, and many of them had to walk.
Blimey. Then he gets the call from the old man himself, Enzo Ferrari, in the Ferrari headquarters at Maranello, asking him if he wants to take on a new challenge. And something quite extraordinary happens, because since Ferrari have been making motor cars or racing cars since the 40s and 50s, it's always come out of Italy. And Barnard managed to pull off a quite remarkable trick.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was at this stage that the Prince of Darkness thing had sort of permeated his entire being. He was having rows with Ron Dennis. Things were coming apart. And now he describes in the book, actually, this was a sort of a confidence crisis. Even though he had started winning championships, he was worried about, he needed a change, and he wasn't sure how he could keep innovating at McLaren, and he was all about innovation. That was probably a mistake, he thinks back. But anyway, he got this call, this mysterious call, from a guy claiming to be from American Express, saying that they wanted to meet him. A European team were interested in talking to him. This is in 1986. And to cut a long story short, after a series of secret meetings, it turns out this is a character called Marco Piccinini, who was at Ferrari, who invited him to be to come over to Italy by private jet and come and see Enzo Ferrari. And John basically said, no, I've just bought this fantastic new house in London, in Godalming, and I'm earning very good money now. So they doubled the money, and he still wasn't interested. And he said, look, I don't want to move to Italy. I want my kids to grow up in England. I don't want to be them traipsing around the Formula One world following me. So then the offer came via Enzo Ferrari, who he met later, that they would move the Formula One design and build operation to Godalming, from Maranello, from the capital of Formula One, if you like, the mecca of Formula One. It was extraordinary, and of course the Italian press went bananas, as you would imagine. I mean, can you imagine McLaren moving, or somebody like that, or Lotus, or a famous team moving from England to some village in France because they fancied the designer? It would just cause mayhem.
But it worked, and Ferrari, you know, came back into the fold and started winning races again.
Well, yes and no is the answer. And this is where the problem, and this is the one of the problems with John Barnard's career. Yes, they did. He went in and completely revolutionized the situation at Maranello, as well as at the Godalming factory. He built aerospace facilities in the village of Godalming. Changed the way that Ferrari started, built its chassis. Up to that point, the engine had always been king at Ferrari. And now John Barnard has arrived as technical director and everything was changing. But it took time to get them back towards the front. And the other big problem there, of course, was that he's because he was so keen on innovation, he wanted to change. He decided to invent the paddle shift steering, the paddle shift semi-automatic gearbox, where you change gear just by flipping paddles on the wheel. And the reason why he wanted to do this was he was angry with the width of the cockpit. He said, "I don't see that." He thought the gearbox, the gear stick, got in the way. And he thought, if I get rid of that and just make it electronic, then I can make the whole cockpit narrower. Now, the big plus of an electronic gearbox like that is that you can keep your hands on the steering wheel as you're going through the corners. If you're driving through, say, Monaco, the Monaco Grand Prix, you make 4,000 gear changes. That's 4,000 times at high speed that you take your hand off the wheel. And that's dangerous, as people have found out. But if you don't have to take your hand off the wheel to change gear, and more, if you're zooming down the straight at 200 miles an hour and then you drop it into first in a normal gearbox.
Yes.
Terrible news. But happily with the paddle shift, you click down through all the gears and the gearboxes and the engines last longer. It was a brilliant innovation that everybody had to follow.
4 years at Ferrari, then he moves to Benetton, where there's, again, another change of design for philosophy, and also a young talent called Schumacher comes on the scene.
Well, quite, yes. Schumacher, well, basically what happens, he goes to Benetton with the same task that he's been given at Ferrari, to completely rebuild it and bring it into the aerospace world. John Barnard has come up with something that's known as the Blue Book, and it's basically a specification for aerospace parts made to aerospace spec in titanium and all sorts of things like that, and exotic materials, and that has spread throughout Formula One. Now, so he's upgrading Benetton, but he falls foul of the politics between himself and Flavio Briatore.
Really? That's strange. I mean, I thought everybody gets on with Flavio.
Yes, well, it's not a surprise, is it? But things went badly wrong, and they're explained in detail in the book. We probably haven't time to go into them here. But that was a very frustrating period for him, and Schumacher was just coming in as he was going out, but he would encounter Schumacher again at his second stint at Ferrari.
Yeah, and then to be asked back to Ferrari, because Enzo famously said why he didn't rehire Derek Bell, because Derek Bell was a Ferrari driver in the 60s. He famously said, "I never reheat cold soup." And yes. However, I know the old man had gone by this point, but he found himself back at Ferrari for another 4 years.
Well, yes, exactly. It was, and not only that, but they had to rebuild the facility in Godalming because they'd previously sold it to McLaren. So they had to build Barnard another one who still wasn't shifting because he had this philosophy. One of the things that is strange about him in comparison to other Formula One people was that his family was so important. It was really the focus, more so than this extraordinary innovation that he brought. And he wanted to be able to go home for lunch. Now, this all springs from a moment in childhood when, at infant school, he'd been in a tight family, his mother and father both engineers and he the only child. He'd gone to school and had been left there for lunch and had a tantrum, really, and he never, ever, after that, stayed at school for lunch, and he mostly went home right throughout his Formula One career, except when he had to be abroad. He made sure he could always go home for lunch to be with his family. And so this is what happened again. The Italians and Ferrari were forced to rebuild at Godalming. And there, again, he came up with a series of fantastic innovations, the most famous of which, perhaps, is the dashboard on the steering wheel. Having got the paddles, the gear shift onto the steering wheel, and because the steering wheel conceals the dashboard, he thought, well, obviously, let's put the dashboard on the steering wheel. And was the first to do so, and, of course, that was the creation of these extraordinary steering wheels worth over £200,000 each, or whatever it is, drivers so gaily throw out of their cars when they get angry.
Isn't it something sort of laudable, though, about, you know, in this, where we are constantly told, especially in F1, where it's millions getting thrown everywhere, even if you're hitting if you've got the pit board, and they're bust around the, you know, or they're flown around the world to do events here and there and the other way. And here is a man who says, no, I'm going to put my family first, I'm going to put myself first, and I'm going to go home for lunch every day and spend time with my family.
Yes, it caused some trouble, of course, because some people didn't like the fact. But to give him his due, what he also did was he was very fair with the people that worked for him. Now, there were, of course, he was known as the Prince of Darkness, and when he was in Godalming, he was known as the Godalming Scud. He did have his harsh side, and he could lose his temper, but he did care about the people that worked for him. One of the interesting things was that he promoted female designers. His mother was an engineer, rare at that time, back in the Second World War, when he was born, 1946, just after. And he promoted female engineers, he believed in the idea of family, and he believed in all sorts of things that you wouldn't really associate with Formula One people. He is, I mean, to give him his, to be fair, reasonably sort of right-wing sort of chap, but quite liberal-minded and creative in many ways, and that sort of fed into his whole creative output.
How would you like to interview, and when you first approached him about doing this book, did he welcome, did you get an attack by the Godalming Scud then, or was he quite amenable?
Well, I was warned that he was the Prince of Darkness, so I was a little bit trepidatious and somewhat nervous, and he... But he seemed to be very approachable. And when I said, well, look, I see that nobody's done your biography. Why is that? And he said he had never met anybody who he particularly trusted to do his biography, though now he was considering it. This is nearly, you know, 9 years ago or however long it was that we started. And he was considering it because he kept on reading stuff about innovation in Formula One that was just wrong as far as he was concerned. And we got on pretty well, but he asked the key question, okay, what do you know about Formula One? Now, at the time, I knew very little about Formula One. And he said, what makes you think you can write this book? And I said, look, I've worked in television news back in the day. My children didn't really take an interest in that. I suspect your children have not taken much of an interest in what you've done in Formula One. And he said, no, they hadn't. He said, well, because I'm working from the beginning and the outside, I'm going to write a book about what you did that they will understand and so will everybody else. And that's what convinced him to do it, really.
And since then as well, I mean, did other people want to speak to, were other people quite willing to speak about his, you know, his influence and how, you know, he'd shaped careers and made winning cars?
Absolutely. I mean, through a friend, I got a paddock pass to get into a series of Formula One races, mostly at Silverstone. And the paddock there and all the journalists there and indeed all the principals there were incredibly welcoming to me because I came in with this passport that I'm writing the official biography of John Barnard. They're a small family. They keep themselves to themselves despite obviously being on a big stage. They are quite tight-knit, but they really welcomed me in, and everybody who was anybody was willing to speak about John Barnard. In fact, a common greeting was when I said, I'm writing the story of John Barnard, they go, oh, how is the Prince of Darkness? They have a fondness for him and a respect for the extraordinary impact he had on the sport.
Perhaps because he's not there all the time now, it's probably easier to, in hindsight, rather than he was skulking around a racetrack somewhere, I'd imagine.
Absolutely, yes. I think it's the sort of absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Indeed. And now he's moved away from F1 after stints at Prost and Arrows and also some MotoGP racing, and he's got a new passion, which, if you think about the high-tech, fast-moving world of F1, it's kind of bizarre, but then again, form follows function, all that. It's kind of fitting. He's now doing furniture design.
Yes, he's doing a number of things, actually. Some of them I know about, but I can't go into. But he has created, with a British designer called Terence Woodgate, a most beautiful table. Now, it doesn't sound like much, except when you learn the details. It's 6 metres long. It has four legs, as tables often do, but that's pretty few over a distance of 6 metres. You can pick it up between two people. You can put a mini car in the middle of it, and it will flex 2 inches. It's made of carbon fibre, of course. It's elegant, it's beautiful, and it sells for hundreds of thousands of pounds.
And a bit of a talking point if you do put the mini in the middle of the table. The book is called Nick Skeens, the book is called The Perfect Car, the biography of John Barnard. It's by Nick Skeens. Nick, if people want to find out more about you or buy the book, how can they get hold of you? Do you do the social media thing?
Yes, Nick Skeens, how would you do that? You could probably find me on Facebook, and you can find the book itself on Amazon, of course. It's there, and will be in big bookshops this week.
Indeed, by Evro Publishing. Now, we always get press notes here, Nick, when we get given these things and the, you know, bits and pieces about authors. And normally they say so and so has been involved with motor racing, whatever, doing for 20 years, and they live in, you know, and they live with their families in, you know, Godalming or somewhere. And your notes say that you live on a barge somewhere in Essex that you designed and built yourself.
Yes, well, that's true. About 20 years ago or more, my wife and I were looking for a family home. And we thought, well, wait a minute, this is going to be very expensive business. We've got three kids and we want it to be nice. And then we decided we'd look at the possibility of a houseboat. So we found a hull, an old concrete hull from the Second World War, which is very, very tough, made of that military-grade concrete that they make pillboxes out of. And we converted that into this spacious, wonderful playground for kids and a party boat, really, and that's where I live now.
Sounds absolutely marvellous. The book is The Perfect Car, the story of John Barnard, Formula One's most creative designer. It's out now, it came out yesterday, by Evro Publishing. It's by Nick Skeens. Nick, thanks for your time today.
And thank you for yours.